If the names Hot Coco, Betty Boop, Julia Child, and Strike It Rich are familiar to you, then you probably have guessed our guest this evening. It's Tom Carruth. He's joining us today to talk about his rose hybridizing adventures as well as his work as curator of the Huntington Rose Garden. Rose Chat is just around the corner. Stay with us.
It's time for the Rose Chat Podcast, a podcast dedicated to celebrating the world's most beloved flower, the rose. Join award-winning gardeners Chris Van Cleef and Teresa Byington as they chat with rose lovers and experts from around the globe. With each episode, you'll gain valuable knowledge and insights to achieve the rose garden you've always dreamed of. Listen now as we explore the world of roses. You asked for it, you got it. Access the Rose Chat Podcast app from your iPhone or Android device. Find instructions at rosechatpodcast.com.
Tom served for many years as Director of Research, Marketing, and Licensing at Weeks Roses, and he is now the curator of the Rose Garden at the Huntington. This world-renowned research library located in San Marino, California, boasts a wealth of resources, including a collection of fine art and a world-class rose garden. Last fall, I had the pleasure of visiting this rose garden, and I can tell you for sure, it is something special. Now, Tom is in the studio, and will be joining us in just a moment, so stay with us.
Rose Chat Radio is a proud media sponsor of the American Rose Society's Fall National Convention, taking place September 10th to the 13th in Syracuse, New York. Michael Marriott, Alon Mayon, Will Radler, and Thomas Prohl will be speaking, and the country's preeminent rose exhibitors will compete for top honors. There's something for all lovers of roses at the ARS Fall National Convention. Register soon at newyorkroses.org. Your friends at Rose Chat Radio will love to see you there.
Well, it's time to talk roses, so welcome to Rose Chat, Tom.
Hey, thanks, Teresa.
We're so glad to have you. You know, Tom, I feel like we're old friends, maybe even family, as so many of my roses bear your name. I received an early education. Yeah. Well, I feel like I received my early education in roses from rose catalogs like Jackson and Perkins catalogs.
Yes. Yeah, those are some great catalogs, weren't they?
Oh, man. They made everything just sound beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. That was the late 80s. Were you there at the time?
I was there in the mid-70s, from 76 to about 79.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. So what piqued your interest in hybridizing in the first place?
Well, I was a strange child, shall I say. When I was six, I told my parents I wanted to work with flowers. And it totally freaked my dad out. He thought I could be nothing but a florist. And by the time I was 11, I had my first rose garden. And I had sold Burpee seed all summer to get enough money to buy it. And it was from a mail-order nursery now long gone where you got nine different colors, none of which had names, and a peace rose. So that was my first rose garden back in the panhandle of Texas. And that year there was a brand-new All-America winner called Mr. Lincoln. And I wanted it so bad, but I didn't have enough money to buy it. Then I got to college, or I actually got to high school and fell in love with genetics, and plant breeding was the natural combination.
So from there, from growing, then how did you jump into hybridizing?
Well, the hybridizing was pretty easy. I started having to do school projects, and the plant breeding really piqued my interest. And by that time, we had moved to Dallas, and Ernie Williams was breeding miniature roses in his back garden at that point. And I pestered that poor soul to death. I don't know how many projects I did off of him.
Oh. Well, see, now, the mentoring. We think mentoring is so important. And there you had your mentor built in right there.
Definitely.
I think that's a lot of our success is when we get paired with someone who knows more than we do. So do you consider that your time with him was valuable?
Yes, Ernie was a great teacher, and I've been fortunate enough to have many mentors over my time, including Herb Swim and Bill Warner and Sam McGrady. Mm-hmm. I especially value my time with Herb Swim. He was just a fantastic person and a great teacher and a fantastic rose breeder.
Well, I was just going to say, Tom, that you know, I see that all over the rose industry, that folks just come along beside you and they want to help you and they want to help teach you what they know. It's just been amazing for me to see that. You know, you don't see that in every industry.
You really don't, and it's quite unusual. Even amongst rose breeders, we are competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we are there talking and giving and sharing. Ralph Moore was a primary example of one of the great persons to share of his knowledge. And he was just such a wonderful person and such an unusual horticulturist. He didn't really go by the books. He did things his own way, which mostly succeeded, and had a fantastic career along the way.
I think we're always very lucky when we can get paired with people who go their own way and do things a little bit differently. It just expands the knowledge in general, don't you think?
Very much. Very much. Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't be on the air today had we listened to what everyone told us.
Isn't
you know,
that
I had the same
truth?
Thing in college. I had a great professor. His name was J.C. Ralston. And this was at Texas A&M, and J.C. was a phenomenal horticulturist, and I would ask him, do you think I can make a living breeding roses? And he would laugh, and he would pat me on the back and say, you could do that when you come home from your real job.
Yeah.
Sounds like he was giving the same advice your parents were giving you in your early days. So you had several levels of that, but you persevered, and we're so glad that you did. Do you even know how many roses bear your name?
I know I have over 100 introductions now.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Did you throw a party at 100?
No, I lost count at that point.
I'm sure you did. We, you know, rose growers have the same problem, especially Chris and I. We talk about how many we have. My husband sort of sat me down and said, now, how many roses really are in this garden? Because you always tell people, oh, about 150. And he says, I think we need to do a count. So we have a selective way of counting the roses, I think.
It can get scary, can't it?
Yeah. It's best we don't know, I think. Now, I'm sure that there are people listening that are thinking, hey, maybe I've got a gift. Maybe you know, I need a tip or two to get me started. So what would you say to those budding hybridizers?
You know, what we've been talking about, don't listen to the naysayers. Go out there and fulfill your dream and give it a try and think broadly. In many cases with the amateur hybridizers, they're just looking at the flower, and they need to look beyond that flower to the plant and what it looks like in the garden, how well it grows in the field, and how it survives in multiple climate. So think broadly, breed broadly with as broad a genetic pool as you can find, and let yourself out of the box.
You know, there are some really good up-and-coming hybridizers that are, you know, basically amateur hybridizers that we're seeing come out. You know, Rafiq and Sunny Bular come to mind, as well as Andy Vannable. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know or have met them, but, you know, they're sort of stepping out of that, you know, typical hybridization box and trying some new things. So that's very good advice for someone who's pursuing hybridization as a hobby as well as a career possibility.
And it's really an opportunistic time for the amateur hybridizers right now, because let's face it, the industry has gone through some tough periods.
Mm-hmm.
And we're under corporate management in many cases, and when you tell them it takes 10 years to develop a product, the accountants don't tend to like,
you know,
so the
we
amateur
hear that
breeders, you know, kind of bear that cost of their own, and then they can make use of it, as we did with Dr. Potschmidt in Cincinnati, and Frank Strickland, who bred St. Patrick. You know, there was a primary example of an amateur breeder who really didn't have that large of a pool, but he struck it.
And Mr. Potschmidt, that dream come true. I'll tell you, that's a rose that a lot of people won't have a garden without now. That's an outstanding rose.
It's a great variety.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were talking a little bit about different things that we would look for in a rose. You know, so often we get asked the question, you know, well, what rose should I get? And there's so many questions that come into mind, you know, your time, and, you know, if you're going to spray or not spray, those kind of things. So I'm wondering, you're in the world of roses all the time. What do you see when you look into the future? you know, what does your crystal ball tell you that's coming down the pike with the world of roses?
You know, we still have to stress ease of care, because more and more gardeners are not willing to put the time in, not willing to spray their gardens, which is fine. You know, they want it all, but they don't really want to do a whole heck of a lot. And they don't want it to fill their entire garden space. So we have to think about tidiness in the landscape, about profusion of flower and fragrance. Fragrance is a key factor. And then disease resistance, so that these varieties can withstand conditions where they're not pampered. One thing I always sought in my hybrids was floriferousness. I wanted them to just bloom their guts out. And I wanted to hold a tidy habit, and I wanted to look good all the way through the life of the flower, and I would love them to be fragrant, and I would love them to be clean. And I don't want them to lose the romance of the rose. The cut flower breeders right now are breeding for shipability, and as a result, they've lost the romance of the flower. They've got an artichoke on a stem.
Well, I haven't heard that one before, but you've got a point.
So we can't lose the fact that we have this wonderful inborn romance to this product. And we can't lose sight of the fact that it must be fragrant. And that has really come back home to me, coming to the Huntington and dealing with the public in a public situation. That is the first thing they do is smell. And the first thing they ask about is fragrance. And
that
we're fortunate
so
that we've made some great steps forward in getting good roses that are fragrant. We are on the right path, but it moves a little slowly.
Sure. Sentimental comes to mind.
Yes. And the lovely fragrance of Julia Child, too, her licorice fragrance. Is fantastic.
That's so unusual. It's interesting to see people try to identify that fragrance when they put their nose in that rose. They're like, this is so unique.
One of the changes we made at the Huntington is to dedicate two beds to nothing but exuberantly fragrant varieties. Because that's the most common question is, where are the fragrant roses? And if you can point them in one direction, then they're happy. And then you watch them as they walk down these rows and begin to smell and smell and smell and smell. They start picking up these different fragrances and go over and talk to them about the licorice, about the clove scent, about the spice scent, about the myrrh scent, you know, and the classic damask scent. And you can see their eyes just light up as they begin to discover this world of different fragrances, which they thought was pretty mundane in comparison. And I love finding unusual fragrances to point them to, like, we have Out of the Blue in the garden, which smells a lot like Lemon Pledge. Then Sugar Moon, that smells like Pond's Cold Cream.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm kind of evil. I plant that in their mind. I said, go smell that one. It smells like Pond's Cold Cream.
They start rubbing it on their face.
Absolutely. Well, you talked about we need the charm and the romance of a rose, because that is so important. And as I take bouquets, deliver bouquets often to the nursing home, when you can tell that the memories that they have of the fragrant flowers, I mean, it is so important to them. When I take something in that's fragrant, and I can't always do that, but when I do, you know, they're starting to tell the story. They're there. They're 8 again, or they're 15 again, or they're, you know, in their mom's garden, or their grandma's garden. And once you have, you know, that's so much a part of our memory and our pleasure is the fragrance that a plant has. So it's so important that we have it. And I'm glad that there's more attention being paid again to fragrance and roses.
Oh, you nailed it exactly, Teresa. If you ask people what their favorite flower is, 9 times out of 10 is going to be fragrant. Because that impressed them as a kid, you know, and that imprinted at that point. And that brings the memories back to them, and that's why they're seeking it.
Well, since I've been to the Huntington, and I know how very special it is, tell us a little bit more about the garden. We know now that there's pockets of fragrant roses, but tell us a little bit more about your work there.
I have actually been associated with the Huntington as a volunteer for over 30 years. but it was mostly in the plant sale area because I am a plantaholic, and plant sale volunteers get first choice. But beyond that, I've seen that garden go through a lot of changes. It has tremendous potential, tremendous potential. The rose garden is just 3 acres out of 170 acres that we actually garden. So it is a huge collection of plants. And Mr. Huntington was collecting plants in the wild over 100 years ago. So some of the specimens we have are of magnificent age and wonderful presence. And it's just a tremendous collection, and it just keeps growing. We've recently added a phenomenal collection of cycads, which are our primitive pine ancestors that go back to the dinosaur ages. And we're going to have a prehistoric forest of these wonderful plants. So beyond my love of roses, as I attributed, I am a plantaholic, and I love being amongst other plant people, and we can just kind of genus and species ourselves to death at this point. But it's a delightful place to be because it's such a broad spectrum.
Yeah. So you can just, like, geek out on plants. Under
we can totally
totally geek out on plants.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you said that about being a plantaholic, because every year here at the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, we have a spring plant sale, and I always want to work the member sale. My wife says, that's just because you want the best plant.
You got it. That's the secret.
Yeah.
That's the secret indeed.
So we've had a lot of fun with the rose garden at the Huntington, bringing it back into good condition again by adding some other plants. We've added a wonderful collection of bulbs, which are mostly South African bulbs, which naturalize well in Southern California, and people don't see them too commonly. So this brings us color when the roses are down, you know, from the winter pruning, and gives us some interest and complexity to the garden, and works in the conditions. My whole feeling is this garden should be a garden that anyone in Southern California can pull off without a great deal of work. So our garden is a no-spray garden, no insecticides, no herbicides, no fungicides. We're predominantly organic. There are going to be points where it looks great, and there will be other points where you'll think, well, but, you know, that's part of going organic and sustainable is that you're going to be a subject to weather conditions, and you're going to have some great bloom periods, and other times things aren't perfect, and it's okay.
That is so important for all of us to learn, that it's okay.
It's a hard lesson for a lot of people.
It is. You know, we've had seasons of perfection, and this is something that we need to relearn, that it's okay. So will you be adding other structures or anything to the rose garden? Or I noticed that there's just lots of really neat structures and that kind of thing.
Well, we have a huge trellis in the rose garden, which we've now completely replaced after about a year and a half. So that was a big factor. Then we have these wonderful old faubois arbors that are made out of concrete to look like tree stumps or like trees. And Mr. Huntington actually went to a faubois exhibit in Paris and came back and had these built in the Japanese garden and in the rose garden over 90 years ago. And those are being painstakingly restored by a wonderful artist. And we actually had him build us two completely new structures, which are these faubois freestanding tree stumps that are containers. And that's what you saw the flower girl picture in. Mm. We planted flower girl in the top of these wonderful containers, and they're concrete.
I'll tell you, that's beautiful. Yeah, well, I'm looking at that picture now that you tweeted earlier today, and it is something to see. For those of you who are listening, y'all go out and follow Tom on Twitter, Tom Carruth Roses. He posts some wonderful pictures as well as information on what's going on in the garden.
So you'll be able to see those faubois tree stumps, you know, on the tweet. And Terry Egan is the artist, and he's done just a fantastic job of this bark and wood structure that you would think was wood, but instead it's concrete. My favorite question was, what type of tree did you start with to get this?
Oh, yeah. Now, you talked about seasons when it was more beautiful. What is the peak season there at the Huntington for the roses?
Well, our spring bloom is normally in April. This mm-hmm. year we were 3.5 weeks early because it was a hot January. So it's been a most bizarre year. And we usually have a very good, we'll have color throughout the season. In fact, we pinch the growth to interrupt the timing so that there's almost constantly color in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll have another good peak bloom in October, classically, and we'll have color even into December.
So would January be the time that you do your cutback then? Because when I was there in October, it was beautiful.
January is pruning mad.
Do you have
so
a team
how
of
many
volunteers that come in and help with that?
Let me answer the volunteer question, okay?
Yeah. We're very interested in that, obviously.
We could not exist without our volunteers. We have a great cadre of volunteers. We have about 48 volunteers in the Rose Garden now, and they help us deadhead. They help us prune. They help us clean. They help us water, whatever we need to do. And it's
wow.
a phenomenal team effort, and that's one of my jobs is to keep that as a spirited team, active and
mm-hmm.
working to help us out, because I only have two gardeners for those 3 acres. So they're
so
a key
factor.
You
do need your volunteers.
Yeah,
oh,
we love
okay.
our volunteers. They are great. And between the botanical department, the art department, and the library, which is a huge section of the Huntington, we have
mm-hmm.
over 1,200 volunteers.
Wow. Couldn't do it without those guys, for sure.
No way.
Now, there's one more thing that struck my eye when I was there, and, of course, I had to have my picture made in front of the big sign that says, ask me about roses or something like that.
Yeah,
do you have
right.
volunteers? There was a picture recently of you and Ping Lim there, I think.
Right, that's right, yeah. Yeah, that's our docent table. So
mm-hmm.
we have our more trained volunteers who will come in and occupy the docent table during our visitation hours and answer people's questions about
mm-hmm.
the Rose Garden. So that's why we put the banner up behind it. And you might have noticed on the table there was this very artful piece of gutter, house gutter, where the docents pick flowers and make their own little display so they can talk about different roses. There on the table.
Oh, how clever. I didn't know. I didn't know that what that was. That is so clever.
So each docent can make their own arrangement and, you know, talk about what they want to talk about. And we'll have visitors come up and take pictures of our gutter.
Absolutely. I'm sure they would. Well, Tom, this has been wonderful. This has been so nice to have you. We certainly
well,
appreciate
you,
giving us your time and telling us about all the things that you've done and are doing and the wonderful work at the Huntington. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate it very much. It's nice to talk with you both.
Now, to learn more about the ongoing work of Tom Carruth at the Huntington Garden, you can visit their website at huntington.org. Follow Tom on Twitter, Tom Carruth Roses. We're out of time for this broadcast of the Rose Chat Podcast. Until next time, happy gardening from your friends at Rose Chat.
You've been listening to the Rose Chat Podcast with Chris Van Cleve and Teresa Byington, expert rose gardeners who want to help you achieve the rose garden of your dreams. Don't miss an episode. Listen anytime on our website at rosechatpodcast.com or listen on the go via the Rose Chat app on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Share this podcast with your social networks and join us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using the hashtag RoseChat. Join us next time for another edition of the Rose Chat Podcast. The Rose Chat Podcast is a production of the Rose Chat Media Group, Birmingham, Alabama.